Hear the music.
Another week. This week we're going to talk about upgradable contracts, right?
Yeah, so we're going to talk upgrading contracts. So I think it's kind of nice to talk about the philosophy of upgrading contracts and sort of like what the sort of backbone behind that is and like some of the sentiment. I would say like maybe the first time I really heard people really kind of iterating on upgradable contracts was the idea of introducing Create two, which was going to allow you to create a predictable contract address for the first time. And then around DevCon 4 in 2018, there was a great debate before I think about proxy contracts were added into OpenZeppelin, which is a place where a lot of Ethereum developers go to get contract standards or implementations of contract standards. And so there was a lot of talk about should these smart contracts be upgradable? And like, what does that mean for users? Should that mean that you deploy a new address every time? Should you write yourself hooks in to change the contract state? Which I think a lot of people were doing back in at that time, where not a lot of people were doing it, but enough were like considering doing that to be able to get out of problems like the DAO hack and things like that. So philosophically, it's been like a wave of different like sort of feelings about that, where there's kind of like this code, this law kind of thing. Like once you write the contract, then like it should not be updatable or upgradable. You should have to deploy a new contract address. And that is kind of just a place where I feel like a lot of the blockchain was at back in 2018, maybe 2017, where if you like messed up a smart contract, you would then have like that flexibility. You wouldn't have any flexibility of doing anything but to the either just pause your contract and deploy a new contract. And then figure out how to play all those transactions to recreate the contract state somewhere else.
Yeah, I think even like more recently, an example of that that we saw was Ether Orcs, where they had like a game-breaking bug in their original contract, and they had to do like this kind of like really painful migration. Like it's good that happened like early, but like yeah, it would be amazing if you didn't like curb your initial traction with that. Right, and having to move everybody over to a new contract instead, like using, you know, something like an upgradable contract solution.
Yeah, that's very true. And like, it's kind of an interesting thing because people were often, I guess the arguments that I had heard before were that people were very concerned about the trustworthiness of contracts. If you were to deploy a smart contract and then there's a way for this contract to update, then you could essentially rug pull everybody. And so everyone, like a lot of the concerns about proxy contracts, which at the time were just a very sort of simple way of being able to point your contract data or update your contract data, was like very much so kind of frowned upon because it's like, how can I trust you if you have the ability to change things on me? But I think one of the things that kind of emerged over like sort of NFT summer was that, hey, people are already doing these rug pulls and they didn't actually need to upgrade their contract to do it. People would just either delete the metadata for the NFTs or mess up the NFT contract on purpose. And so, like, really, there was no security and just, like, not having any sort of path to upgrade and any sort of lockout. And so it's been this kind of evolution, at least on the Ethereum side of things, that instead of thinking that you always have to get it right the first time, to try and get it right iteratively, and then to set your contract owner address or your admin address when you're sure that things are right to 0x0. So it's like, oh, it's been running in production for a while. Everyone feels good about this. Or alternatively, just like don't set it to anything at all. You just always have that as an option for your users. Because at the end of the day, like smart contracts themselves are products that have a certain level of trust, like baked in to the coordination aspect of things. And so like someone changing the smart contract code on someone is a very public affair. Like there's no way to hide that you did that because the transaction will always show up on the blockchain. And you can replay it and you can see like who sent the transaction, and then you can try and figure this out. And like that's kind of an interesting like sense of security. Like Shane, what would you say has been like the biggest argument against upgradable contracts? Would you say that that's been your experience in the Ethereum ecosystem?
Yeah, I think people are definitely in that realm of like code is law, which like I agree, right? Like coming from ETC, to think code is law like makes a lot of sense. But when you're trying to ship something, you know, that might not have been done before, like Etherworks, for example, like it's really hard to figure all that out, you know, ahead of time. So I do like the idea that you were talking about before, talking about transferring ownership. So there's Open Zeppelin has an ownable contract, which gives you transfer ownership and renounce ownership and a couple other methods. And I believe there's like, obviously we use a facet for that, but the idea is that you get it into like a stable state and then you transfer ownership to, like you said, 0x0. And then at least it gives you a bit of leeway to get it into like a stable state or, you know, battle test it on the blockchain before, you know, or like if you catch a bug or that kind of thing early. And when you know you're stable, then you do the transfer ownership, right?
Yeah. And so like that's kind of like a big thing for like bugs and sort of bug fixing and things like that, where if you're like, I guess we should rewind and just for like some of our listeners, like smart contracts on their own are not upgradable. Like you have to essentially code yourself an upgrade path into the smart contract itself. And so there's a couple different approaches that you can do to do this. And so transferring ownership like means that like if you had one of these upgrade paths, presumably these like upgrade paths would not be accessible to anybody because you would then transfer the ownership of the contract to 0x0, and that would be the end of it. And so for regular users, I would say they don't have a lot of transparency into whether or not the contract is upgradable. There are a couple of things you can look for. You could look for delegate call. You could look for an ownable, like you mentioned, and like a couple other things around call and execute. You can also look for a self-destruct, which means that like that someone has the ability to just like blow the contract up. That's useful. And those are kind of like signs of like, oh, this contract can change its state from what was originally deployed and like what people know about. Yeah, so it's kind of like idea of like transfer ownership, and then when you think it's stable, or you don't transfer ownership and you always have upgrades. So, like, I think Ethereum's ecosystem about that, for whatever reason, I think it has to do with the emergence of Bitcoin and this being kind of like Ethereum being like this idea that you're going to have programmable Bitcoin more than just like Bitcoin scripts. And so, like, Ethereum started to adopt this kind of code as law until the DAO hack, and then things became a little bit more flexible. But then there was still some hesitancy, I felt, from the community to think really deeply and like accept, like, sort of like this idea that your contract can change. And I think at DEF CON 4, people were really playing around with this idea of forkable contracts. So, what you would do is you would then say, hey, look, we're going to upgrade our contract, but instead of like keeping the same address, we're going to make a fork. And the fork is going to be the new address that has all of the same state as the old address. And it would just kind of do a copy of state. And then you would then have the ability to keep using the old version, but none of the applications of the application layer would support it. And so there was some like, oh yeah, that's the way it should be because there's no centralized control. But the realities of that, I think, were that like maintaining different versions of access to an application is like actually a hard problem for even centralized apps, let alone decentralized applications. And so, like, it just kind of fell away to the wayside. And then I feel like with the NFT summer and people getting more into these contracts and like sort of messing like deployments up, messing soft launches up, I think there's emerged a sort of new excitement around techniques for safely upgrading your smart contracts. And I think OpenZeppelin did a lot of work there to make an upgradable a part of their code repository or library. And I think that's kind of where Ethereum was. But having come from like the near ecosystem, I would say, and like near ecosystem, you could say, I think hit mainnet in either 2020 or 2019. I like COVID basically just, I don't even know about time. There's like a time period of stuff that happened there. And I don't know if that was 3 years or 2 years ago. It's just like an abstract amount of time. It's like AD and BC, it's like, oh, post-COVID, or oh no, that was
Yeah,
before COVID,
exactly.
definitely. But then, because the Near protocol launched so late, with smart contracts being at the forefront, and the contracts being written in Rust, and the memory layout of like the Ethereum smart contracts really versus the near smart contracts really lends itself to upgradability as a first class citizen. So one of the weird challenges of being in a smart contract ecosystem where people can change is the fact that because of this mutability that's really been embraced by the community, it means that smart contract standards are often getting additions and sometimes changing a little bit, which is like really sort of radically different, you know, because we think about Ethereum, and Ethereum has tried to upgrade the ERC20 fungible token contract through new standards, and they simply can't do it. Because too many of these contracts themselves have no upgrade path. And then additionally, a lot of the culture is that the standard is frozen in stone. But having worked in like sort of the near ecosystem, for better or worse, like it's possible that your standard might change and you might be prompted yourself to upgrade your contract to represent this new evolving standard, which is like, because like,
Yeah, like in some cases you don't want to get left behind, and in the other cases you don't want to break user land, right? So it's like a very fine line for doing
yeah,
upgrades.
and so like there was a recent upgrade within like the near standards for NFTs and NFT contract behavior. And so they kind of have their own open Zeppelin kind of thing going, where there's like sort of official contract standards that you can inherit. But part of that was to start emitting events. And I know that down the pipeline, they're going to change radically the event format. So if you're in that ecosystem, like no one is setting any contract to 0x0, which is like kind of crazy, but no one is upset.
Yeah, it's like a different culture, right? If you start out with upgradable stuff, maybe that never even comes up.
Yeah, and that like so it makes you wonder, like, and I think you can start to see that like upgradability maybe in both ecosystems has never really been that big of a deal. It was more of perceived like wrong to be able to do something than it was like an actual like, oh, this is like something that like society deems threatening. It's like I always like that Bruce Schneier, like the security guy, his like talk about like security and trust, and it's like, oh, you go to a restaurant, but you don't expect the other people sitting at the restaurant to like attack you with their fork and knife, so they're not glued down to the table. So it's like, oh, you just trust that, you know, the laws of society and like the rules of society itself are generally enough to protect you. So it's like if you're in this particular dApp ecosystem and like they rug pull or do something that's completely untrustworthy, you're probably never going back to that again, just as you would any other product. And so I think Ethereum, as it gets in the hands of more users, are starting to find that, like, hey, look, well-intentioned, like contract designers, let's call them contract designers, like, aren't, yeah, they aren't like, they aren't responsible. Like, they can't be faulted. Well, they can be faulted if they don't give themselves a way to fix problems with their own, like, code. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think, like I said, there's like a fine line there between upgradability and the longevity of your contract's API, right? And the functionality that it does, because you don't want, like, in one case you want to be able to upgrade it for bugs, but the other case you probably don't want to break any APIs and break user land and break whatever dApps that have been created on top of it. So there's definitely some balance that has to be done there on the developers' behalf. Well, not behalf, but like on the developers, like they have to think about a lot, right?
Yeah, it's a lot to like sort of think about, and then to think about what the community itself wants. So, yeah, I think it's been like an interesting ride out there. So, the real sort of question is can we, how are people going about upgrading? So maybe we should talk about some of the options that are out there if you do decide to go for like creating an upgradable contract. I think from my perspective, upgrading contracts, as observed in a culture full of upgraded contracts, has like a lot of terrible things about it, but a lot of good things too. So, for instance, like one of the largest makers of NFTs on Near had a thing where they had misimplemented like one of the like standards because they were so early in the ecosystem. Like the standard looked slightly different. And so they were returning entirely the wrong data. And it meant for me, who was constructing at the time a secondary marketplace, I couldn't list their NFTs. And they were like the first or the second largest producers of NFTs in that ecosystem. So
That's brutal.
I popped into GitHub, I rolled up my sleeves, I looked at their code, and like I figured out like, okay, here are the things that you've implemented slightly wrong. You may have missed that the standard updated. And within like 2 weeks, some testing on their end, they implemented the changes, rolled out the upgrade, and I could then represent other people's NFTs on my secondary marketplace. And that's something that
Man, that's pretty
that's
cool.
pretty that's pretty that's pretty bo it's pretty baller. Because like without that, there would have been no pathway, and we would have been in this kind of weird state where, like, here's this really large producer that's producing two types of NFTs and has no pathway of ever like doing anything.
Well, yeah, reconciling with the rest of the
Yeah.
ecosystem.
Now, the flip side of that is like there are a couple of things that are coming down the pipeline where like you might get left behind or you might not have the engineering resources. So let's say that you deployed one of these old school NFTs that like within Near they recently implemented events. And so like there are all these events that NFTs are supposed to put out, and there's a risk that like maybe someone will index your stuff. Because your NFT is slightly early, it doesn't implement it. And so, like, you as like the person that did this deployment maybe 2 years ago, because like we'll say 2020, now are at risk that your NFT is like never going to show up in anyone's wallet. It's not going to be tradable. And so I think it's kind of an interesting thing to think about, like, what can you do in those circumstances? And I think on Ethereum, I think maybe you can talk about this. Wasn't CryptoPunks not originally in the current NFT standard?
Yeah, I think that it has to be wrapped to use it on like OpenSea and stuff. Like, it looks kind of similar, but all the methods are like named differently and like short names and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it looks kind of close. But yeah, you have to do this kind of like wrapping where you make like another contract that can accept that old format, lock that old one away. Issue a new one, right? So that you can sell those on OpenSea.
Yeah.
So it kind of messes up the provenance there, right?
Yeah, it does 100%. And so like it's kind of like an interesting like side effect of like the good and bad of sort of upgrading. So I think like maybe now is a good time to talk a little bit about like what are the options? Shane, do you want to roll us through some of the options that we have? If we are going to upgrade anything.
Yeah. So, well, we got the first option, which is you don't. So you have like just a regular smart contract, you deploy it, and then, you end up maybe with a bug later, and you have to basically fork your community over to an entirely new contract, maybe do some sort of one-to-one swap. It gets like really hairy if you have to go through something like that. The second one, I would say, like the second level of upgradable contracts would be a proxy. So what that means is you just have a very thin contract that points to another contract, but keeps all the state within the very thin one. And you do that via delegate call. And what that does is just traps the state there so that when you swap it out for a new address later, you end up keeping the state there, which is kind of amazing that there's a way to do that in Solidity. So that is the second layer. And then the third layer would be a multi-proxy. So we were talking about the proxy, and now we're talking about the multi-proxy, where, again, it's a very thin layer, but you assign which methods go to which proxy so that you could have multiple. You can break up your contract into not just like, you know, one-to-one with the proxy, but you can break it up into like, okay, I want to deploy this contract. It implements these 8 methods. This other contract implements these. And then the state is actually shared through that very thin layer.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's like a pretty good breakdown of the different options and trade-offs. And so it's kind of like, I think a lot of the sentiment is like, oh, okay, you've got this contract, you're ready to deploy these things. Now, like, we have a way of changing the state later so we're not in a pickle, we're not in a bind. And I think one of the interesting things, because I think EIP 2535 is getting close to being finalized. And so it's been like, what, a 4-year journey? And so EIP 2535 is like a diamonds contract, which is what Shin was talking about earlier, a multifaceted proxy contract. And so basically what a diamond is that you have all of these different contracts that are just logic contracts. So they're supposed to basically just describe the functionality of the different features that you want. And then those things all sort of reference what's considered the diamond contract, which contains the storage for all of the state variables. And then there's a very clever way to make sure that the storage sections for each of these contracts don't intersect. And so that means that they like sort of namespace them, or you figure out how to make sure that the memory sections of your contract don't collide. And so the way Ethereum memory works is that you might start with like an ordered section of memory, unless you explicitly say, I want to store data in this particular addressable space. And like, not to get too technical, but an addressable space within Ethereum is up to like the same amount of space and a UNT256. So that space is like billions of different addresses. So the address space is so large that if you are randomly choosing space within those sections, and so what people do that, they do this thing you've probably heard of called CACAC 256 or SHA-3. And so what they'll do is they'll run this function over a name that they give, call them blippity boops. And let's say your contract storage is blippity boops. And like Shane has a facet he wants to have called blippity boops 2. Then he'll like SHA-3 that, and I'll SHA-3 blippity boops 1. And then we'll be at radically different spaces. Like his SHA-3 might be 0x dead beef, and mine might be feed, 0x feed. So very different addresses. It's even larger than that. So there's such a little probability of collision that we might as well just throw it out the window. And so you do this for your storage, and it gives you this nice flexibility of being able to keep extending your contract. So you might start out with a contract that I have a function that allows you to mint an NFT. But the next thing is like Shane has a really cool idea for like breeding an NFT. And so he'll write the facet for it, deploy it to contract address. And then we will update the diamond to point to that new, to add that new facet to the list of facets to our diamond contract, which will then mean that when you go to use the smart contract, you'll all of a sudden have the ability to call Mint and Breed from the same contract address, which is like, is there anything you want to?
Yeah, exactly. It's great for doing those kinds of feature upgrades because it's not like you really want to make a new contract for breeding, although I've seen it done. It would be like amazing if you could keep it within the same contract and just keep expanding it. One good example of that is like the Avogadro stuff.
Yeah, right? Avogadro is actually the first project to use this live in production. I don't know. Do we dare say 4 years ago? Maybe we'll say 3 years ago. I don't want to say that. Maybe 3 years ago. It was definitely like pretty close.
Yeah, that's too much to age.
Yeah, yeah, right? It's too much. It's getting there. Maybe it was 2 years ago. I don't know. Maybe mainnet 2 years ago. I don't know. Something. So it was a while ago, and so it's been running in production for a long time, and they have all of this ridiculous gaming stuff. It's like there's so much like functionality in that. It would make your head swim. But
yeah. They just keep building more and more functionality into it. It's like pretty amazing right. to see.
And like kind of the other thing is like a lot of things that like people don't really realize, especially like if you're not coming from a technical background, is that you're actually only dealing with, I think, 24 kilobytes of code. And so like a kilobyte is like 1,000 times smaller than a megabyte, which is like 1,000 times smaller than a gigabyte, which is like 1,000 times smaller than a terabyte. So we're talking about a really small amount of code. And I don't even know how to like conceptualize that. Because I think a lot of people don't deal in kilobytes so much anymore. I mean, to a certain extent, like even images on a standard Web2 website are almost like hitting up to 1 megabyte. And you're looking at like a website itself is probably 20 megabytes once you get all the assets, which is just kind of insane. But like we're saying that there is actually a code size limit for how much data you can deploy in a single contract. And one of the things that Avogadro hit was this code size limit. So their smart contract, because they add so many functions, so much stuff, was just like too much code for a single contract. So you need to break it up. But then, you know, you don't really want to have your contract split across like 18 addresses. That seems like a little bit hard for users to manage. Like, what are they signing? Do you know like what the Tamagotchi, like whatever proxy staking liquidity pool like addresses? Maybe not.
Yeah, it's really confusing.
It's tricky to manage. So that kind of led to thinking about a way to split the code up. So facets, because each facet is a smart contract itself, allow you to scale out your smart contract to where it can like take up much more space, infinite space that you're willing to pay for. You can make your contract that large. And then I think the storage space that you're limited to is quite large as well, right? I think the storage space is slightly under 2 to 64. So maybe it's like a gigabyte or something. Something you would never hit on like an L1 just because of the cost. But an L2, maybe not. So like,
yeah, maybe start hitting.
Yeah. So like that's kind of another interesting thing is like when you start to think about upgradability, larger contracts, like, what's that situation feel like on an L2? Like, what can you even do on an L2?
Yeah, I feel like I would be a lot more inclined to do it on an L2 just because of the economics around it as well, like being able to pay to easily upgrade it, and like yeah, it costs like slightly more to do it with the extra deploys of the diamond contract, right? But I think being on an L2 and being able to like deploy easily with very low cost, I feel like is a big thing to gain from like even proxies on L2s. It's still better to keep your community under the same contract than, every time you find a bug, you got to make a new contract.
Yeah, it's way better than that. And then, like, sort of the other thing to talk about the cost aspect is that there is a potential future. I don't know if it's a future that everyone trusts or not, where like we were talking about 0x zeroing like contracts where you can define a standard set of functionality for a facet. Where it's a reusable facet. So one person that's clever deploys how that smart contract works. And the only thing that you're responsible for is setting the address of the contract to use. So like the tweet I just added was talking about reusable facets. So in this case, you would deploy the facet once, make the address public. This is a case in which you would want to 0x0 the address so that that facet is not ownable in any kind of way. And so what that would mean is that you're essentially locking that kind of functionality in place. And then you say, hey, look, if you refer to your the storage in this facet is going to point towards these slots and you're contract and you don't reuse this storage, then you have a way of extending the functionality of your contract without actually implementing any of the code to do it, which is like pretty freaking nuts, right? It's an upgrade path. So like before we were kind of talking about how Near had this kind of problem where some of the functionality had changed, but then like the developers kind of had to like go through whatever upgrade process that they had. And like on Near, it would be a little bit tricky because it's a sharded chain. So you got to really think kind of deeply about what it means to make a cross contract call. So like diamonds may not really make sense in that ecosystem. But on Ethereum, because you can say that someone has implemented a particular standard, like enumerable, for instance. And if you follow like a kind of common pattern for that, then it's possible that you could be able to extend your contract in like a predictable way without writing any code. You just pick up the functionality. Yeah. And so I think that pattern of diamonds is interesting.
Yeah, and we've seen actually some amazing examples of this. Like, we've seen Dan Finley's Delegatable project that he's working on, which implements like a normal, Open Zeppelin style contract, but it also implements a facet that is delegatable so that you can use it, with the whole diamond standard, which is like amazing. So that's just like one example, but there's so many more. Like the solid state guys are doing some good diamond work over there to do ERC 721s and some of these other standards as like laying out the base contracts for that using the diamond storage and all that stuff. So there's lots of really amazing projects going on in that space to try and get reusable facets for everyone.
Yeah, and like so like if we look at like where we think things are going, I think that it's pretty clear that, like, we as a, I guess, a society at this moment in time are like starting to like realize that, like, having a path to upgrade isn't doesn't make you a demon. It doesn't make you a bad person necessarily. It's just like every contract and every sort of messy thing that like represents our physical realities can be like sort of manifest or paralleled to like our contract state. And so having the ability or the tool in your tool house to choose when you're going to have something be upgradable or not is like definitely a thing that's like should exist and is worth doing well.
Yeah, I think this is just like the start of like really the exploration of upgrading contracts. And I think it's going to be exciting to see what else people come up with and what other facets that like can be easily reused. So yeah, it's pretty exciting
Yeah,
stuff.
because like that's one of the things I think has been kind of interesting too, is to think about like, so I linked this one about the, let's see, the solid state enabled, a diamond enables users to be aware of upgrades 30 days before upgrades are enabled, which is pretty cool to be able to be like, oh, have a status page that says, hey, look, at this block, we're going to turn on this facet. And so, like, everything's going to change. So, when we talk, I guess I talk a lot about token economics. So, I've been like hanging out and doing hosting a study group on complex systems with tokens. And, like, one of these things that have been kind of lingering in the back of my mind has been about why there's not A/B testing for token economies. And, like, I think part of that reason is the technical reason of how do you, like, I don't know, pull the rug on your users? No. How do you change the algorithm of like your minting contract or radically change the way that the economics of your ecosystem work and like keep all the addresses the same, like manage that state and that rollover without just confusing people and saying like, oh no, that's the old V1 address and this has been deprecated and now you've got to use this V2 address. Technically, with doing things like bucketing off your upgrades, say like 30 days in advance or 15 days in advance, you can start to build the functionality in to enable people to like sort of transition their like state without actually doing anything. So it's like, oh, cool, I have this token. The way you get this token is totally different now. I have an exchange method that I can put onto the exact same contract that I've been using this whole time. And there's like nothing that changes. So that's like,
Yeah, it's interesting what kind of use cases that we'll see come out of it, right? Like we talked about one amazing one with Avogadro and overcoming the smart contract limits, but it'll be great to see what people come up with there.
yeah, for sure. And I think like when we think about like contract upgrades, there's like another sort of thing as to who can upgrade, when are you going to upgrade, and like what does it look like? I think we saw an example in reading in which someone was saying, what if you got the DAO to vote community-driven upgrades to the contract? So that's like a definite possibility where different people can deploy facets, right? And then they can deploy their own, like their own diamonds, right? That could be the experimental one. And because you have this ability to just add diamonds as they come, you can start to allow people to play around with this in a public way. So it's like, here are the potential upgrade candidates. And then you just add those diamonds to the test diamond contract, and people can do whatever they want, you know? And like, it's very easy to put all of the functionality together in a collaborative way. And like, maybe that contract gets garbage because someone does something like stupid or crazy, or maybe it doesn't, but it at least gives you that ability to start experimenting.
Yeah, agreed. I think like the DAO voting on upgrades is like a really cool thing to explore. Like reusable facets, like an app store for facets or like a library store for facets would be awesome. Yeah, those are really cool ideas I think need to be
Yeah, that's
explored.
definitely true. And like, about this thing about the sort of duality of things that you gotta like be able to like represent. So we talked about upgradability, but the ability, the 0x0 in a facet store is like critical. Because then that means you can absolutely trust the code that's like up there. So earlier I was talking about how like upgradability is the bee's knees, but really it's a messy world. So like being able to like lock your shit down and to like also open things up are both equally needed.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to wrap
Yeah, for
up.
sure.
All right, well, thanks for listening to our chat about upgradable
Yeah.
contracts.
See you
See you
next
next
week
week.
and check us out on Spotify. We also have each episode added to the Shane and Zane show. So yeah, be sure to check out the full show if you missed this here. Catch us there. Catch us anywhere. Everywhere. We're in the ether. No. Okay, that's enough. All right, I'll catch you later. Thanks.
To load. There we go. Another week. This week we're going to talk about upgradable contracts, right?
Yeah, so we're going to talk upgrading contracts. So I think it's kind of nice to talk about the philosophy of upgrading contracts and sort of like what the like sort of backbone behind that is and like some of the sentiment. I would say like maybe the first time I really heard people really kind of iterating on upgradable contracts was the idea of introducing Create 2, which was going to allow you to create a predictable contract address for the first time. And then around DevCon 4 in 2018, there was a great debate before I think of proxy contracts were added into Open Zeppelin, which is a place where a lot of Ethereum developers go to get contract standards or implementations of contract standards. And so there was a lot of talk about should these smart contracts be upgradable? And like, what does that mean for users? Should that mean that you deploy a new address every time? Should you write yourself hooks in to change the contract state? Which I think a lot of people were doing back in at that time, where Not a lot of people were doing it, but enough were like considering doing that to be able to get out of problems like the DAO hack and things like that. So philosophically, it's been like a wave of different like sort of feelings about that, where there's kind of like this code, this law kind of thing. Like once you write the contract, then like it should not be updatable or upgradable. You should have to deploy a new contract address. And that is kind of just a place where I feel like a lot of the blockchain was at back in 2018, maybe 2017, where if you like messed up a smart contract, you would then have like that flexibility. You wouldn't have any flexibility of doing anything but to the either just pause your contract and deploy a new contract and then figure out how to play all those transactions to recreate the contract state somewhere else.
Yeah, I think even like more recently, an example of that that we saw was Ether Orcs, where they had like a game-breaking bug in their original contract, and they had to do like this kind of like really painful migration. Like it's good that happened like early, but like yeah, it would be amazing if you didn't like curb your initial traction with that. Right, and having to move everybody over to a new contract instead, like using, something like an upgradable contract solution.
Yeah, that's very true. And like, it's kind of an interesting thing because people were often, I guess the arguments that I had heard before were that people were very concerned about the trustworthiness of contracts. If you were to deploy a smart contract and then there's a way for this contract to update, then you could essentially rug pull everybody. And so everyone, like a lot of the concerns about proxy contracts, which at the time were just a very sort of simple way of being able to point your contract data or update your contract data, was like very much so kind of frowned upon, because it's like, how can I trust you if you have the ability to change things on me? But I think one of the things that kind of emerged over like sort of NFT summer was that, hey, people were already doing these rug pulls and they didn't actually need to upgrade their contract to do it. People would just either delete the metadata for the NFTs or mess up the NFT contract on purpose. And so like really there was no security, and just like not having any sort of path to upgrade and any sort of lockout. And so it's been this kind of evolution, at least on the Ethereum side of things, that instead of thinking that you always have to get it right the first time, to try and get it right iteratively, and then to set your contract owner address or your admin address when you're sure that things are right to 0x0. So it's like, oh, it's been running in production for a while. Everyone feels good about this. Or alternatively, just like don't set it to anything at all. You just always have that as an option for your users. Because at the end of the day, like smart contracts themselves are products to have a certain level of trust, like baked in to the coordination aspect of things. And so, like, someone changing the smart contract code on someone is a very public affair. Like, there's no way to hide that you did that, because the transaction will always show up on the blockchain. And you can replay it and you can see, like, who sent the transaction. And then you can try and figure this out. And like that's kind of an interesting like sense of security. Like Shane, what would you say has been like the biggest argument against upgradable contracts? Would you say that that's been your experience in the Ethereum ecosystem?
Yeah, I think people are definitely in that realm of like Coda's Law, which like I agree, right? Like coming from ETC, I think Coda's Law like makes a lot of sense. But when you're trying to ship something, you know, that might not have been done before, like Etherworks, for example, like it's really hard to figure all that out, you know, ahead of time. So I do like the idea that you were talking about before, talking about transferring ownership. So there's Open Zeppelin has an ownable contract, which gives you transfer ownership and renounce ownership and a couple other methods. And I believe there's like, obviously we use a facet for that, but the idea is that you get it into like a stable state and then you transfer ownership to, like you said, 0x0. And then at least it gives you a bit of leeway to get it into like a stable state or, you know, battle test it on the blockchain before, you know, or like if you catch a bug or that kind of thing early. And when you know you're stable, then you do the transfer ownership, right?
Yeah. And so like that's kind of like a big thing for like bugs and sort of bug fixing and things like that, where if you're like, I guess we should rewind and just for like some of our listeners, like smart contracts on their own are not upgradable. Like you have to essentially code yourself an upgrade path into the smart contract itself. And so there's a couple different approaches that you can do to do this. And so transferring ownership like means that like if you had one of these upgrade paths, presumably these like upgrade paths would not be accessible to anybody because you would then transfer the ownership of the contract to 0x0 and that would be the end of it. And so for regular users, I would say they don't have a lot of transparency into whether or not the contract is upgradable. There are a couple of things you can look for. You could look for delegate call. You could look for an ownable, like you mentioned, and like a couple other things around call and execute. You can also look for a self-destruct, which means that like that someone has the ability to just like blow the contract up. That's useful. And those are kind of like signs of like, oh, this contract can change its state from what was originally deployed and like what people know about. Yeah, so it's kind of like idea of like transfer ownership and then when you think it's stable, or you don't transfer ownership and you always have upgrades. So like I think Ethereum's ecosystem about that, for whatever reason, I think it has to do with the emergence of Bitcoin and this being kind of like Ethereum being like this idea that you're going to have programmable Bitcoin more than just like Bitcoin scripts. And so like Ethereum started to adopt this kind of code as law until the DAO hack. And then things became a little bit more flexible, but then there was still some hesitancy I felt from the community to think really deeply and like accept like sort of like this idea that your contract can change. And I think at DEF CON 4, people were really playing around with this idea of forkable contracts. So what you would do is you would then say, hey, look, we're going to upgrade our contract, but instead of like keeping the same address, we're going to make a fork. And the fork is going to be the new address that has all of the same state as the old address. And it would just kind of do a copy of state. And then you would then have the ability to keep using the old version, but none of the applications of the application layer would support it. And so There was some like, oh yeah, that's the way it should be because there's no centralized control. But the realities of that, I think, were that like maintaining different versions of access to an application is like actually a hard problem for even centralized apps, let alone decentralized applications. And so like it just kind of fell away to the wayside. And then I feel like with the NFT summer and people getting more into these contracts and like sort of messing like deployments up, messing soft launches up, I think there's emerged a sort of new excitement around techniques for safely upgrading your smart contracts. And I think Open Zeppelin did a lot of work there to make an upgradable a part of their code repository or library. And I think that's kind of where Ethereum was. But having come from like the NEAR ecosystem, I would say, and like NEAR ecosystem, you could say, I think hit mainnet and either 2020 or 2019. Like COVID basically just, I don't even know. About time, there's like a time period of stuff that happened there, and I don't know if that was 3 years or 2 years ago. It's just like an abstract amount of time. It's like AD and BC. It's like, oh, post-COVID, or oh no, that was like that was before COVID, definitely. But then because the NEAR protocol launched so late, with smart contracts being at the forefront and the contracts being written in Rust and the memory layout of like the Ethereum smart contracts really versus the NEAR smart contracts really lends itself to upgradability as a first class citizen. So one of the weird challenges of being in a smart contract ecosystem where people can change is the fact that because of this mutability that's really been embraced by the community, it means that smart contract standards are often getting additions and sometimes changing a little bit, which is like really sort of radically different, you know, because we think about Ethereum and Ethereum has tried to upgrade the ERC-20 fungible token contract through new standards, and they simply can't do it because too many of these contracts themselves have no upgrade path. And then additionally, a lot of the culture is that the standard is frozen in stone. But having worked in like sort of the NEAR ecosystem, for better or worse, like it's possible that your standard might change and you might be prompted yourself to upgrade your contract to represent this new evolving standard. Which is like, because like,
yeah, like in some cases you don't want to get left behind, and in the other cases you don't want to break user land, right? So it's like a very fine line for doing
upgrades. Yeah, and so like there was a recent upgrade within like the NEAR standards for NFTs and NFT contract behavior. And so they kind of have their own Open Zeppelin kind of thing going, where there's like sort of official contract standards that you can inherit. But part of that was to start emitting events. And I know that down the pipeline, they're going to change radically the event format. So if you're in that ecosystem, like no one is setting any contract to 0x0, which is like kind of crazy, but no one is upset.
Yeah, it's like a different culture, right? If you start out with upgradable stuff, maybe that never even comes up.
Yeah, and that like, so it makes you wonder, like, and I think you can start to see that like upgradability, maybe in both ecosystems, that's never really been that big of a deal. It was more of perceived like wrong to be able to do something than it was like an actual like, oh, this is like something that like society deems threatening. It's like I always like that Bruce Schneier, like the security guy, his like talk about like security and trust, and it's like, oh, you go to a restaurant, but you don't expect the other people sitting at the restaurant to like attack you with their fork and knife, so they're not glued down to the table. So it's like, oh, you just trust that, you know, the laws of society and like the rules of society itself are generally enough to protect you. So it's like if you're in this particular dApp ecosystem and like they rug pull or do something that's completely untrustworthy, you're probably never going back to that again, just as you would any other product. And so I think Ethereum, as it gets in the hands of more users, are starting to find that, like, hey, look, well-intentioned, like contract designers, let's call them contract designers, like, aren't, yeah, they aren't responsible. Like they can't be faulted. Well, they can be faulted if they don't give themselves a way to fix problems with their own like code. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think, like I said, there's like a fine line there between upgradability and the longevity of your contract's API, right? And the functionality that it does, because you don't want, like, in one case you want to be able to upgrade it for bugs, but the other case you probably don't want to break any APIs and break user land and break whatever dApps that have been created on top of it. So there's definitely some balance that has to be done there on the developer's behalf. Well, not behalf, but like on the developers, like they have to think about a lot, right?
Yeah, it's a lot to like sort of think about, and then to think about what the community itself wants. So, yeah, I think it's been like an interesting ride out there. So, the real sort of question is can we, how are people going about upgrading? So maybe we should talk about some of the options that are out there if you do decide to go for like creating an upgradable contract. I think from my perspective, upgrading contracts as observed in a culture full of upgraded contracts has like a lot of terrible things about it, but a lot of good things too. So for instance, like one of the largest makers of NFTs on Near had a thing where they had misimplemented like one of the like standards because they were so early in the ecosystem, like the standard looked slightly different. And so they were returning entirely the wrong data. And it meant for me, who was constructing at the time a secondary marketplace, I couldn't list their NFTs. And they were like the first or the second largest producers of NFTs in that ecosystem. So
That's brutal.
I popped into GitHub, I rolled up my sleeves, I looked at their code and like I figured out like, okay, here are the things that you've implemented slightly wrong. You may have missed that the standard updated. And within like 2 weeks, some testing on their end, they implemented the changes, rolled out the upgrade. And I could then represent other people's NFTs on my secondary marketplace. And that's something that
Man, that's pretty
that's
cool.
pretty that's pretty that's pretty buck. It's pretty baller. Because like without that, there would have been no pathway. And we would have been in this kind of weird state where like here's this really large producer that's producing two types of NFTs and has no pathway of ever like doing anything.
Well, yeah, reconciling with the rest of the
Yeah.
ecosystem.
Now, the flip side of that is like there are a couple of things that are coming down the pipeline where like you might get left behind or you might not have the engineering resources. So let's say that you deployed one of these old school NFTs that like within NEAR they recently implemented events. And so like there are all these events that NFTs are supposed to put out, and there's a risk that like maybe someone won't index your stuff because your NFT is slightly early, it doesn't implement it. And so like you as like the person that did this deployment maybe 2 years ago, because like we'll say 2020, now are at risk that your NFT is like never going to show up in anyone's wallet. It's not going to be tradable. And so I think it's kind of an interesting thing to think about, like what can you do in those circumstances? And I think on Ethereum, I think maybe you can talk about this. Wasn't CryptoPunks not originally in the current NFT standard?
Yeah, I think that it has to be wrapped to use it on like OpenSea and stuff. Like, it looks kind of similar, but all the methods are like named differently and like short names and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it looks kind of close. But yeah, you have to do this kind of like wrapping where you make like another contract that can accept that old format, lock that old one away. Issue a new one, right? So that you can sell those on OpenSea.
Yeah.
So it kind of messes up the provenance there, right?
Yeah, it does 100%. And so like it's kind of like an interesting like side effect of like the good and bad of sort of upgrading. So I think like maybe now is a good time to talk a little bit about like what are the options? Shane, do you want to roll us through some of the options that we have if we are going to upgrade anything?
Yeah. So, well, we got the first option, which is you don't. So you have like just a regular smart contract, you deploy it, and then, you end up maybe with a bug later, and you have to basically fork your community over to an entirely new contract, maybe do some sort of one-to-one swap. It gets like really hairy if you have to go through something like that. The second one, I would say, like the second level of upgradable contracts would be a proxy. So what that means is you just have a very thin contract that points to another contract, but keeps all the state within the very thin one. And you do that via delegate call. And what that does is just traps the state there so that when you swap it out for a new address later, you end up keeping the state there, which is like kind of amazing that there's like a way to do that in Solidity. So that is like, let's say the first or second layer. And then the third layer would be a multi-proxy. So we were talking about the proxy, now we're talking about the multi-proxy, where again, it's a very thin layer, but you assign which methods go to which proxy so that you could have multiple, you can break up your contract into not just like, one to one with the proxy, but you can break it up into like, okay, I want to deploy this contract. It implements these eight methods. This other contract implements these, and then the state is actually shared through that very thin layer.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's like a pretty good breakdown of the different options and trade-offs. And so it's kind of like I think a lot of the sentiment is like, oh, okay, you've got this contract, you're ready to deploy these things. Now, like we have a way of changing the state later so we're not in a pickle, we're not in a bind. And I think one of the interesting things, because I think EIP 2535 is getting close to being finalized. And so it's been like, what, a 4 year journey? And so EIP 2535 is like a diamonds contract, which is what Shane was talking about earlier, a multifaceted proxy contract. And so basically what a diamond is that you have all of these different contracts that are just logic contracts. So they're supposed to basically just describe the functionality of the different features that you want. And then those things all sort of reference what's considered the diamond contract, which contains the storage for all of the state variables. And then there's a very clever way to make sure that the storage sections for each of these contracts don't intersect. And so that means that they like sort of namespace them, or you figure out how to make sure that the memory sections of your contract don't collide. And so the way Ethereum memory works is that you might start with like an ordered section of memory, unless you explicitly say, I want to store data in this particular addressable space. And like, not to get too technical, but an addressable space within Ethereum is up to like the same amount of space and a UNT256. So that space is like billions of different addresses. So the address space is so large that if you are randomly choosing space within those sections, and so what people do that they do this thing you've probably heard of called CKAK 256 or SHA-3. And so what they'll do is they'll run this function over a name that they give, call them blippity boops. And let's say your contract storage is blippity boops, and like Shane has a facet he wants to have called blippity boops 2, then he'll like SHA-3 that, and I'll SHA-3 blippity boops 1, and then we'll be at radically different spaces. Like his SHA-3 might be 0x dead beef, and mine might be feed feed, 0x feed feed. So very different addresses. It's even larger than that. So there's like such a little probability of collision that we might as well just throw it out the window. And so you do this for your storage, and it gives you this nice flexibility of being able to keep extending your contract. So you might start out with a contract that I have a function that allows you to mint an NFT. But the next thing is like Shane has a really cool idea for like breeding an NFT. And so he'll write the facet for it, deploy it to contract address, and then we will update the diamond to point to that new, to add that new facet to the list of facets to our diamond contract, which will then mean that when you go to use the smart contract, you'll all of a sudden have the ability to call mint and breed from the same contract address, which is like, is there anything you want to?
Yeah, exactly. It's great for doing those kinds of feature upgrades because it's not like you really want to make a new contract for breeding, although I've seen it done. It would be like amazing if you could keep it within the same contract and just keep expanding it. One good example of that is like the Avogadro stuff,
Yeah,
right?
Avogadro is actually the first project to use this live in production. I don't know. Do we dare say 4 years ago? Maybe we'll say 3 years
I'm
ago.
not doing
I'm
any
gonna
date
I don't want to
naming
say
that.
that. Maybe 3 years ago.
That.
It was definitely like pretty close.
Yeah, that's just it. That's too much to age us,
Yeah, it's
right?
too much. It's getting there. Maybe it was 2 years ago. I don't know. Maybe mainnet 2 years ago. I don't know. Something. So it was a while ago, and so it's been running in production for a long time, and they have all of this ridiculous gaming stuff. It's like there's so much like functionality in that. It would make your head swim. But
Yeah. They just keep building more and more functionality into it. It's like pretty amazing to see.
And like kind of the other thing is like a lot of things that like people don't really realize, especially like if you're not coming from a technical background, is that you're actually only dealing with, I think, 24 kilobytes of code. And so like a kilobyte is like 1,000 times smaller than a megabyte. Which is like 1,000 times smaller than a gigabyte, which is like 1,000 times smaller than a terabyte. So we're talking about a really small amount of code, and I don't even know how to like conceptualize that, because I think a lot of people don't deal in kilobytes so much anymore. I mean, to a certain extent, like even images on a standard Web2 website are almost like hitting up to 1 megabyte. And you're looking at like a website itself is probably 20 megabytes once you get all the assets, which is just kind of insane. But like we're saying that there is actually a code size limit for how much data you can deploy in a single contract. And one of the things that Avogadro hit was this code size limit. So their smart contract, because they add so many functions, so much stuff, was just like too much code for a single contract. So you need to break it up. But then, you don't really want to have your contract split across like 18 addresses. That seems like a little bit hard for users to manage. Like, what are they signing? Do you know, like, what the Tamagotchi, like whatever proxy staking liquidity pool, like addresses, maybe not.
Yeah, it gets really
It's really
confusing.
confusing. It's tricky to manage. So that kind of led to thinking about a way to split the code up. So facets, because each facet is a smart contract itself, allow you to scale out your smart contract to where it can like take up much more space, infinite space that you're willing to pay for. You can make your contract that large. And then I think the storage space that you're limited to is quite large as well, right? I think the storage space is slightly under 2 to the 64, so maybe it's like a gigabyte or something. Something you would never hit on like an L1 just because of the cost, but an L2, maybe not. So like,
Yeah, maybe start hitting limits
yeah.
there.
So like, that's kind of another interesting thing is like when you start to think about upgradability, larger contracts, like what's that situation feel like on an L2? Like, what can you even do on an L2?
Yeah, I feel like I would be a lot more inclined to do it on an L2 just because of the economics around it as well, like being able to pay to easily upgrade it, and like, yeah, it costs like slightly more to do it with the extra deploys of the diamond contract, right? But I think being on an L2 and being able to like deploy easily with very low cost, I feel like is a big thing to gain from. Like even proxies on L2s, it's still better to keep your community under the same contract than, every time you find a bug, you got to make a new contract.
Yeah, it's way better than that. And then, like, sort of the other thing to talk about the cost aspect is that there is a potential future. I don't know if it's a future that everyone trusts or not, where like we were talking about 0x0ing like contracts, where you can define a standard set of functionality for a facet, where it's a reusable facet. So one person that's clever deploys how that smart contract works, and the only thing that you're responsible for is setting the address of the contract to use. So like the tweet I just added was talking about reusable facets. So in this case, you would deploy the facet once, make the address public. This is a case in which you would want to 0x0 the address so that that facet is not ownable in any kind of way. And so what that would mean is that you're essentially locking that kind of functionality in place. And then you say, hey, look, if you refer to your the storage in this facet is going to point towards these slots and your contract, and you don't reuse this storage, then you have a way of extending the functionality of your contract without actually implementing any of the code to do it, which is like pretty freaking nuts, right? It's an upgrade path. So like before we were kind of talking about how Near had this kind of problem where some of the functionality had changed, but then like the developers kind of had to like go through whatever upgrade process that they had. And like on Near, it would be a little bit tricky because it's a sharded chain. So you got to really think kind of deeply about what it means to make a cross contract call. So like diamonds may not really make sense in that ecosystem. But on Ethereum, because you can say that someone has implemented a particular standard, like enumerable, for instance, and if you follow like a kind of common pattern for that, then it's possible that you could be able to extend your contract in like a predictable way without writing any code. You just pick up the functionality. Yeah. And so I think that pattern of diamonds is interesting.
Yeah, and we've seen actually some amazing examples of this. Like, we've seen Dan Finley's Delegatable project that he's working on, which implements like a normal, Open Zeppelin style contract, but it also implements a facet that is delegatable so that you can use it, with the whole diamond standard, which is like amazing. So that's just like one example, but there's so many more. Like the solid state guys are doing some good diamond work over there to do ERC 721s and some of these other standards as like laying out the base contracts for that using the diamond storage and all that stuff. So there's lots of really amazing projects going on in that space to try and get reusable facets for everything.
Yeah, and like so like if we look at like where we think things are going, I think that it's pretty clear that like we as a I guess a society at this moment in time are like starting to like realize that like having a path to upgrade isn't doesn't make you a demon. It doesn't make you a bad person necessarily. It's just like every contract and every sort of messy thing that like represents our physical realities can be like sort of manifest or paralleled to like our contract state. And so having the ability or the tool in your toolhouse to choose when you're going to have something be upgradable or not is like definitely a thing that's like should exist and is worth doing well.
Yeah, I think this is just like the start of like really the exploration of upgrading contracts. And I think it's going to be exciting to see what else people come up with and what other facets that like can be easily reused. So yeah, it's a pretty exciting
Yeah,
start.
because like that's one of the things I think has been kind of interesting too, is to think about like so I linked this one about the let's see, the solid state enabled a diamond enables users to be aware of upgrades 30 days before upgrades are enabled, which is pretty cool to be able to be like, oh, have a status page that says, hey, look, at this block, we're going to turn on this facet. And so, like, everything's going to change. So, when we talk, I guess I talk a lot about token economics. So, I've been like hanging out and doing hosting a study group on complex systems with tokens. And like one of these things that have been kind of lingering in the back of my mind has been about why there's not A/B testing for token economies. And like I think part of that reason is the technical reason of how do you, like, I don't know, pull the rug on your users? No. How do you change the algorithm of like your minting contract? Or radically change the way that the economics of your ecosystem work and like keep all the addresses the same, like manage that state and that rollover without just confusing people and saying, like, oh no, that's the old V1 address and this has been deprecated and now you've got to use this V2 address. Technically, we're doing things like bucketing off your upgrades, say like 30 days in advance or 15 days in advance, you can start to build the functionality in to enable people to like sort of transition their like state without actually doing anything. So it's like, oh, cool, I have this token. The way you get this token is totally different now. I have an exchange method that I can put onto the exact same contract that I've been using this whole time. And there's like nothing that changes. So that's like.
Yeah, it's interesting what kind of use cases that we'll see come out of it, right? Like we talked about one amazing one with Avogadro and overcoming the smart contract limits, but it'll be great to see what people come up with there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like when we think about like contract upgrades, there's like another sort of thing as to who can upgrade, when are you going to upgrade, and like what does it look like? I think we saw an example and reading in which someone was saying, what if you got the DAO to vote community-driven upgrades to the contract? So that's
Yeah.
like a definite possibility where different people can deploy facets, right? And then they can deploy their own diamonds, right? That could be the experimental one. And because you have this ability to just add diamonds as they come, you can start to allow people to play around with this in a public way. So it's like, here are the potential upgrade candidates. And then you just add those diamonds to the test diamond contract, and people can do whatever they want, you know? And like it's very easy to put all of the functionality together in a collaborative way. And like maybe that contract gets garbaged because someone does something like stupid or crazy, or maybe it doesn't, but it at least gives you that ability to start experimenting.
Yeah, agreed. I think like the DAO voting on upgrades is like a really cool thing to explore. Like reusable facets, like an app store for facets or like a library store for facets would be awesome. Yeah, those are really cool ideas I think need to be
Yeah, that's
explored.
definitely true. And like about this thing about the sort of duality of things that you gotta like be able to like represent. So we talked about upgradability, but also the ability to 0x0 in a facet store is like critical. Because then that means you can absolutely trust the code that's like up there. So earlier I was talking about how like upgradability is the bee's knees, but really it's a messy world. So like being able to like lock your shit down and to like also open things up are both equally needed.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to
wrap
up.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, well, thanks for listening to our chat about upgrading contracts.
See you next week. And check us out on Spotify. We also have each episode added to the Shane and Zane show. So, yeah, be sure to check out the full show if you missed this here. Catch us there. Catch us anywhere. Everywhere. We're in the ether. No. Okay, that's enough. All right, I'll catch you later. Thanks.